We now return to Camilo Mejia, GI resistor, conscientious objector, and Iraq war veteran for peace. This is from his talk given December 7th, 2005 in Lawrence, Mass. We join now for the question and answer period.
We had a Marine recruiter who's going to come take questions, but apparently he left. So I'll just take your questions.
When you came back, you were the first, but then it multiplied. Did you share that in terms of what happened after you finally?
When I came back from Iraq, there were no AWOL cases. 2 weeks later, there were 22 cases. 5 months later, there were 500 cases. By the time I got out of jail, it was 5,500. Today is more than 6,000. And these are official numbers given by the Pentagon. So I wonder what the real number is. But what I know is that for one reason or another, although they're not saying anything publicly, there is a quiet rebellion within the military. There are people who are saying this war is not worth fighting or dying or killing for. We're going to continue to work with that silent rebellion until the government can no longer rely on the military to fight this war.
Can you talk a little bit about what it was like for you when you were in prison?
My time in prison actually wasn't too bad. I had been to combat, so jail was therapeutic. Military jail isn't as bad as civilian jail. And you have to add the fact that I had received a lot of attention. And I was in the news, I was in the newspapers, on TV, there were vigils being held outside, demanding my release. I received hundreds of letters sometimes. The most that I received in one day was like 700 and something. In just one day, boxes of mail. So they had to be really careful on how they treated me, because they knew that a lot of people supported me. And it wasn't such a bad time, actually. I had a lot of peace back then. Things got crazy when I got out.
In what way? Where did they get crazy?
Well, you know, when I was in jail, I got to read the Bible. I got to write, keep a journal, write letters, read philosophy, work out, talk to my family every now and then on the weekends, go out and, you know, take a walk during recreation time. And then I got out and suddenly I'm speaking out everywhere, interviews, rallies. And it's my duty, it's my responsibility to create awareness, so I'm not complaining. It's a bit crazy, but it has to be done.
What has been the response since you talked about the non-POW camp? We read a lot about other abuses. Has that been documented? Has there been official response to that? More outcry from what you described?
No, not really. When the Abu Ghraib scandal broke out, they said that this is something that began to happen around November or December of the year 2003. The abuse that I described took place in early May of 2003, basically right after the president said end of combat operations. And we know because of the spooks that, you know, the policy came from the highest levels. And we know that it was systematic, and we know that it started as soon as we got there. Although the government and the media have portrayed the issue as something that happened in November or December of 2003, that it's not systematic, that it's just a few bad apples. But I think that there's a lot of complicity even within the government, within the politicians, the Senate and the Congress, to not really go in depth with their investigations. I know that when I applied for conscientious objector status, my application was really comprehensive. I wrote a 55-page long application describing how I had become a conscientious objector. And I described in detail everything that happened in Al-Assad. And I submitted that to a 2-star general in the military as part of my conscientious objector application. And nothing was made out of it. One of my attorneys submitted a copy of that report to Senator Clinton. And they said that they were just simply going to wait for the Pentagon to conduct this investigation. So they had proof that there had been abuse even before the scandal broke out. I'm talking about March of 2004. The scandal didn't break out until April, I believe. But they simply sat on it and did nothing.
So during your trial, the government, how did they establish that you were not conscious, having made that claim based on your experience?
They haven't, really. I applied for conscientious objector status in March of 2004, and it's still pending. They haven't really made a decision. They didn't allow it in the trial, because basically they brought it down to whether he got on the plane or not. They didn't want to listen about international law. They didn't want to listen about Geneva Convention. They didn't want to look at case law. They didn't want to listen to the witnesses that my attorney asked to bring. Key pieces of evidence were not allowed in the court. So the judge saw all of that in what is called the pretrial motions, but before the jury came in. And then all the motions were systematically struck down, each and every one of them. So by the time the jury came in, none of it was presented to them. I'm pretty sure that they had already made up their minds anyway, but the arguments were not allowed.
So you're going around to groups and you're kind of seeing what people are doing. Is there anything in particular that you're saying, oh, that's a really good idea, this is a good way to fight what I've seen, more than any other? Or are they all just ways to plug into the solution?
One thing that we do at Iraq Veterans Against the War is what we call informed recruiting. We don't really call it counter-recruiting, because the moment you tell a young person not to do something, it's precisely what they want to do. So what we do is we offer them our experience, because my experience as active duty, as being in the active duty, being in the National Guard, having been in the military for over 10 years, having been to war, having been in the military in peacetime, being a Latino immigrant, being a conscientious objector, having been to jail, I can offer a number of different perspectives that a recruiter will not offer. So if young people are to join the military, they need to join with their eyes open. I was talking to a recruiter today who was here earlier, and he was saying, well, we do tell them that they could go to war, but that's not enough. What is war? It's not just something that you read about in a book. The military and the government learned a lot from the Vietnam War, when actually people got to see footage of soldiers in Vietnam, soldiers posing with dead Vietnamese, prisoners of war, children, civilian casualties, little girl running naked from napalm. But right now, people don't really know what war is. There's a soldier who lost a leg and an arm in a grenade attack, and he's from a group called Operation Truth. And he went to a mall, and a high school kid asked him, what happened to you? And he said, I lost my arm in the war. The kid said, what war? He said, the war in Iraq. He said, that's still going on? They don't really know. I mean, if you tell somebody that you're going to join the military and that you could go to war, and then you tell them you knew what you were getting yourself into, they don't know what they're getting themselves into. We don't trust 18-year-olds with beer, but we trust 17-year-olds with a rifle, and with going to war and making life and death decisions. So that they don't really have a clear view of what it is that they're getting themselves into, and we offer that view. And I don't ever tell children, don't join the military. I tell them, if you're going to join the military, this could happen to you. And I think that has a great impact. You know, you still empower them by allowing them to make their own decision. You don't tell them, don't do this. You don't dictate to them. You allow them to build an informed decision.
What kind of reaction are you getting from minority groups? You know, the kids you talked to today, and what other groups have you been talking to as we've been going around? It sounds like you've been making an effort to get to the kids, and especially in minority neighborhoods and areas. So talk about that.
I have visited some high schools. This tour has been really successful in that matter, because I've met with a lot of minorities, and I've visited a lot of inner city schools where there's heavy recruiting going on, like here. And some of the schools I've been to are really militarized. Like one of the schools we went to, it was in Chelsea, I believe. We went in there, and I haven't seen as much security since I came back from Iraq. They had a cop, they had a security guard, the teachers came out, and one stood at the, you know, by the stairs, and the other one stood in the hallway. The principal came with a walkie-talkie to escort us to where we were going. It's really amazing. So these kids need to hear from veterans who are coming back from Iraq. And this tour, although it has been really exhausting, has been really fruitful and really productive in that matter. As far as college students, they're really receptive. Every now and then I get a couple of military types who are really gung-ho, and for the most part they're really respectful. At Salem State I went, and they had a Navy SEAL who had been in 11 years, several combat tours, was an E7, and was about to become a lieutenant. He was pretty pissed. And then they had another sergeant who had been in the military about 6 years. He was really vindictive. The other guy was like more legalistic. This guy was like really vindictive, you know, not letting me really talk, you know, attacking me. Some of the reporters have been quite nasty, particularly here. This guy, Jim Browdy, they told me he was a progressive. Maybe I'm wrong, but that's not what I call a progressive. Seems like he had an agenda. But the majority of the people actually have been really receptive, and the kids really want to hear the story. They have questions, they're really honest and open about it. So it's been a really good tour.
What do you say to the poor kid who sees the military economically as his or her only option? What other kind of things can you share with them that might inspire them to look for a different way to get it?
I basically share my story. I myself wanted to go to college. The military promised to pay. In the end, it turned out that they didn't really quite pay for tuition. And you know, in my case, you know, going to a community college and getting good grades allowed me to go to a private university, you know, without scholarships. There are also scholarships for Latinos, there are scholarships for Haitians, there are scholarships for Native Americans. There's scholarships for all races, people who have high GPAs in school. There's a number of resources that are not reaching the people, that are not reaching the kids. And I tell them one of the things I used to do, I used to go to a Barnes & Noble, buy myself a cup of coffee with a notebook and a pen, and spend the day there just going through the pages and taking down information, and then going home and applying for the different scholarships. So there are ways to finance your own tuition. There are alternatives, you know, you can take out loans and then work as a teacher. Some of the cities will pay for your tuition. They even have master's degree programs. So there are options. And I encourage kids to actually go out there and look for these options.
What signs of hope do you see out there for getting the hospital?
In Iraq? Well, recruiting is pretty low in spite of this town. I hear that they have 10% return on their recruiting efforts, which is pretty high. But overall recruiting is really low. And within the military, a lot of people are deciding not to fight. As I said, the Pentagon alone puts the number at over 6,000. And there are more people coming forward and saying that they disagree with the war, more people putting their weapons down. So there's a quiet rebellion within the military, people who are deciding not to fight the war. That, along with counter-recruiting, is going to take away the muscle to fight the war. And I think that was one of the main things that happened during Vietnam. You had entire units refusing to fight. You had a lot of dissent. You had a lot of people going AWOL, going to Canada, going to Europe. And that's slowly beginning to happen. And the only way out of that is for them to instate a draft. And if they do that, you know, there's going to be mass opposition to that.
Is it true that the troops in Iraq don't have the equipment or protection that they need to, like, bulletproof vests and armored vehicles and things like that? Is that true?
That was true for my unit. We were a combat enhanced unit in the Florida National Guard, which means that we're highly trained, that we had more resources than everybody else. And when we were in Iraq, we didn't get our bulletproof vests until the end of June. Even though we arrived in Iraq in April. The entire time up until that point, we were walking around with this Vietnam-era flak vest that don't stop a bullet if they throw it at you. We were down to 2 bottles of water per day per man, doing foot patrols on temperatures as high as 140 degrees. We were relying on two-way Motorola radios sent by our relatives to Iraq because the army didn't give us radios to do patrols. The vehicles were not armored. So when we actually received the actual bulletproof vests, we used the old flak vests and put them on the walls of the vehicles to help with protection. And for the floors, we used sandbags to protect from shrapnel and from blasts from road bombs. So it's really hypocritical when the government says support the troops, and at the same time, you have people there who don't have basic equipment. And I'm not saying we should have, we're capable of better imperialism. I'm just pointing out the hypocrisy of support the troops while, you know, giving this huge $1 billion contracts, no big contracts to Halliburton and Bechtel. Meanwhile, the troops are not getting the support that they need. So it's true. I'm not sure for everybody, but for a few units, it's true. A lot of people have asked me how I feel about the war in Afghanistan. Because some people, even within the peace movement, are too afraid to touch Afghanistan. 20,000 peace activists marched on Fort Benning to demand the government to close the School of the Americas, which is a school where the government trains soldiers from Latin America so that they can go back to places like El Salvador, Nicaragua, Argentina, Honduras, Chile, to conduct torture, assassinations, to disappear people, to install military dictatorships. So not only do we house these torturers, we train them, we finance them, and we put them in power. So to say that it is justifiable to invade and occupy Afghanistan because they have terrorists would be to say that it is justifiable for the US to be invaded and occupied because we house and train terrorists ourselves.
That was Camilo Mejia speaking on December 7th, 2005 in Lawrence, Mass. He is a GI resistor, conscientious objector, and Iraq War veteran for peace. Now we bring you some people's history, our history, to look back on, remember, and be inspired by. On December 20th, 1990, Army Reservist Dr. Yolanda Hewitt Vaughn refuses orders to report for duty for the Gulf War. This is some of her story, excerpt from Peace Magazine, their June-July 1993 issue. Why was a peacenik serving as a captain in the U.S. Army Reserve Medical Corps anyway? Not as a way to obtain a free medical education. Yolanda Hewitt Vaughn had paid her own way through medical school by such jobs as driving a cab. The explanation was simpler. As a feminist, she had been stung by the criticism that women and peaceniks leave the hard roles for other people. And besides, she thought, the U.S. had learned its lesson from the Vietnam War and would not intervene abroad again. So, during the build-up to the Gulf War, Dr. Hewitt Vaughn was combining several part-time roles as a medical reserve officer, as a civilian family physician, as a wife, and as the mother of three young children. She did not believe war would come. Bush was just showing the flag, and his wife said, the American troops would not be sent to fight in the Gulf. Still, as information rolled in about the probable consequences of a war, including up to 100,000 civilian deaths and an environmental catastrophe from burning oil fields, Hewitt Vaughn had to act. For months, she gave speeches and participated in weekly peace vigils as the war approached. Finally, she packed and reported to In Process for Active Duty. Speaking in Toronto in February, Dr. Hewitt recalled these momentous days. During in-processing, she had told a lawyer that it was almost time for the peace vigil and she would not have time to go home and change. I asked, would it be permissible for me to go in uniform if I just stood quietly and didn't say anything? He looked at me as if I came from another planet. You can't go to a peace vigil at all, he replied. Lots of things happened that week, Yolanda continued. A congressional delegation had gone to the Middle East. When they returned and talked to Bush, he looked irate. We have three branches of government, but he regarded them as intruding on his realm. He made the comment on TV that he didn't care what the American public said, he didn't care what the Congress said, and he didn't care what the press said. If Saddam Hussein was not out of Kuwait on January 15th, he was going to move militarily. We had already mobilized the blood supply to Saudi Arabia. I finally concluded that we had been headed for war all along. We were told to report to receive our orders. I talked with my husband and friends, and we decided to say no. Hewitt Vaughn reported in her civilian clothes and informed a major that she was going to refuse to go. He told her to report to Fort Riley so she would not get charged with missing movement, a grave military offense. She did so, and when she signed out for the weekend, she didn't go back. Instead, she went to Washington to lobby against the war. Although she fitted the criteria to become a conscientious objector, she did not initially ask for that status. She explains, "The issue was not whether I belonged in the military, but whether the military belonged in the Middle East, waging war. I did not want to focus on the personal decision. I was trying to focus on the decision for which each and every American would have to be responsible." When she left her post, she left a letter saying that she would come back. She did so 4 weeks later, after having done everything possible to influence policy. She was charged with desertion with intent to shirk hazardous duty and avoid important service. In her court-martial, she was not allowed to speak about her views of war, about conscientious objection, about politics, or about her philosophy regarding violence. She was not allowed to bring up international law or the rules of war outlined in Army Field Manual 27-2. Such factors would justify her intent not to desert but to fulfill her oath in what she considered the best way possible. When the judge imposed these restrictions, she said, "I was so floored that I stuck a Kleenex in my mouth. I thought, I may as well gag myself because there's nothing I can say here." She could still talk about one topic, medical ethics, but her defense carried no weight. She was sentenced to 2.5 years in a maximum security prison at Leavenworth. She was released after 8 months. Now, we go to Making Waves interviewer, Tom Jackson.
For Making Waves, I'm Tom Jackson, and today I'm talking with Jackie Ellen Dussault. Jackie was one of 25 Catholic workers who took part in the Witness Against Torture, a 50-mile walk from San Diego, Cuba, to Guantanamo Bay to implore the U.S. military to allow access so they could perform works of mercy and bring comfort to the hundreds of prisoners there, many of whom have been waging hunger strikes. By way of introduction, to give people an idea of some of the details that haven't really gotten out in mainstream media in terms of what's happening with the prisoners in Guantanamo, I'm going to read a little bit from just a few paragraphs from the December 2005 issue of the Catholic Worker newspaper. This is an article written by Tanya Terrio. In it, she says, "A June-July 2005 hunger strike was made public on July 20th by former Afghan prisoners. According to attorneys from the Washington, D.C.-based firm Shearman and Sterling, which represents 40 prisoners, in addition to, quote, starving until death, close quote, the protesters planned to boycott showers, recreation time, and called for, quote, no violence by hand or even words to anyone, including the guards, close quote. The military acknowledges 52 men were involved in the strike, but lawyers put the numbers closer to 200. While U.S. senators were getting summer show tours of the camp, CCR, which is the Center for Constitutional Rights, reports that close to 50 men were in IV hydration and that, overwhelmed, the medics ceased regular medical visits. The strike ended on July 28th after the prisoners were promised better access to books, bottled drinking water, and a prisoner grievance committee, but the committee was soon after dissolved. In a statement given to his lawyer, Binyan Mohammed, a British prisoner, said, quote, the administration promised that if we gave them 10 days, they would bring the prison into compliance with the Geneva Conventions. It is now August 11th. They have betrayed our trust again. Hisham from Tunisia was savagely beaten in his interrogation, and they publicly desecrated the Quran again. Saeed from Kuwait was ERF'd, which means he was visited by the Extreme Reaction Force, for refusing to go to interrogation because the female interrogator had sexually humiliated him. Therefore, the strike must go on." Close quote. By mid-September of this year, lawyers for the prisoners reported that as many as 210 prisoners, nearly half, were involved in a hunger strike that began in early August. Jackie Ellen Dussault, thank you for taking some time with us this morning, and I'm hoping that you'll pick things up from sometime this fall, when perhaps the idea of the 25 or so Catholic workers going down to Cuba first started to come together.
Sure. I had been at a retreat on Labor Day weekend and heard a report, a lot of the material that you had just read, and I know a number of us felt like we had to, in some way, respond nonviolently to what we were hearing. One of the problems is that our government is doing these things in places where people have no access, not even the United Nations or the Red Cross. And so we felt like just very humbly walking to this place and saying, if you're not torturing people, then please let us in.
And tell us about your experience from when you arrived in Cuba till when you left a day or so ago.
Sure. We just felt very strongly about having this be a pilgrimage or a walk of repentance. So we walked about 10 miles a day, sometimes more, and we tried to eat only once a day. We camped in people's backyards in tents, and we spent a lot of time while we were walking being silent. And when we stopped, we tried to have liturgy every day, and we tried to read some of the accounts that Amnesty International has done on the people that are being held there, the experiences they've had, exactly how their human rights are being violated, what kind of torture methods are being used. And that just kind of put us in a framework where we were able to move all the way from Santiago City to the Cuban checkpoint where Guantanamo, that area begins.
And once you arrived, you asked to be allowed into the prison. What happened then?
Well, the Cuban government is very alert about anything that might incite the United States military that occupies the end of your country, and they told us, you know, that if the United States called and said that we could be allowed through, that they would open their checkpoints and we would be able to go. So at that point, we began fasting. We set up our tent encampment right there at the gate, and we began calling the base to ask for access.
And their response was?
We were hung up on for the most part.
Really?
And they were absolutely unwilling to let us in. Much like they've been unwilling to let in the Red Cross and you know, the United Nations just canceled the tour they were supposed to have because they were not given full access.
And so the group then, what did you do then when you were refused access?
We just continued to fast and pray and try to be present there and try to speak to the media and try to speak to supporters and friends to put pressure on the government to let us in.
Tell us in a little more detail, what were your plans if you had been let in? What did you hope to achieve?
Well, I think we wanted to really be able to do the work of mercy of visiting the imprisoned. I mean, when people are on a hunger strike and fasting to the death, it's a cry for help and a cry for mercy. You know, they have no other way to express or communicate the absolute horror of the hell that they've been living in. And it's a situation that has no conceivable end. Because they're being denied due process, it's not like they're being accused of a charge and then tried and then, I mean, this is like, some of them have been told, don't ever plan to get out of here. Don't ever have hope for anything. So we really wanted to let them know there are American people who are committed to human rights, who are committed to the Geneva Convention, and who are committed to making sure that, you know, illegal, immoral acts are not being committed by our government with our tax dollars and in our name. And we hoped that that would give them hope. And we really hoped that it would help to begin a movement for the abolition of torture.
Talking with Jackie Ellen Dussault, who was one of 25 Catholic workers who took part in the Witness Against Torture. She's just back from Cuba. Jackie, share some of your thoughts that you've had since your return, reflecting on what happened. Where have your thoughts gone from there?
Well, I had to come home 2 days before everyone else because our community has a Christmas party for 200 kids in our family, in our neighborhood, and kids in our tutoring program. So I kind of landed and had to be on the run. And it's been really challenging to sort of be busy every moment doing the work of the community and also to be so mindful of what it's like for the people that are still stuck in these hidden places. So I've really been reflecting on the fact that, you know, all of us do that. We separate our regular, normal lives with our children and school and work and cooking dinner and chores. And we separate that from the reality that the money we pay for taxes is torturing people. And I think because of the intense situation of being in the walk and fasting and praying every day and having this, you know, tiny amount of grace that allowed us to feel somewhat in solidarity with the suffering going on and be more mindful of it, that sort of split has been very clear to me since I got home. And I think most Americans, we have that split all the time. We're just not aware of it. You know, we really separate what's being done supposedly for the war on terror and in our name from our daily lives. I'd like to think that most people find torture horrible. And I'd like to think that all good people believe everyone deserves human rights regardless of what they've done. I mean, that's sort of a basic moral premise that we hold. And we're supposed to be good Americans. We're supposed to be about democracy. So I think for me it's been really hard to realize that all of us walk around with that split and we never really have to make ourselves think about, you know, the people that are dying and being tortured and suffering every day. So for me that's been kind of a heavy thing to walk around with.
Well, it's definitely a brave thing that all of you got together and did. There's probably some listeners who are wondering if you have any concerns about repercussions from the U.S. government for going to Cuba.
I guess personally I don't, because I feel like, you know, we acted under international law. We acted under upholding the Constitution. You know, the Constitution tells us that laws that you know, the Geneva Conventions and international principles that outlaw torture and that, you know, curtail human rights are, you know, those are binding on us as individual citizens. So if we were ever charged and there was a trial, we would very much look forward to facing the United States government and calling them on the carpet for human rights violations. I mean, people in our government have been acting like war criminals. So I think most of us would look forward to the opportunity to be able to address that. Yesterday I read a report, the State Department made a statement about how dare we be in Cuba and not address them about their human rights violations with prisoners, and I thought, my God, the hypocrisy of that. This is what we're trying to say. How could we possibly address Cuban human rights violations when our country, our government is torturing people on their soil? So what happens is because of the behaviors of our government in these places, we have no standing anywhere to speak about human rights, to speak about human dignity anymore.
The Witness Against Torture campaign, even though people have come home or started to head home, that campaign is by no means over, correct?
Right.
What happens next?
We certainly hope it's a pebble in the pond and that the ripples keep going on and on.
There's a website, I believe, with some blogs and so on.
Yes, photographs and reflections people have written, audio blogs, also a lot of really good links. I would encourage all the listeners, go to Amnesty International and read the accounts lawyers have taken from people being held. You'll be absolutely horrified, and there's no way you can read those things and not do something about it. So the website is www.witnesstorture.org.
And you've actually started to answer my last question here, which was, what would you suggest that concerned people might do, particularly those who might not be in a place where they're ready to go to Cuba or something like that?
Right. I mean, we certainly wouldn't expect everyone to be ready to do that, but everyone can do something. And clearly, whatever people are doing now is not enough. So I would say, if you've never written a letter to your representatives, write the letter. If you've never been to a candlelight vigil, go to a candlelight vigil. Think about withholding a part of your tax dollars and saying, I refuse to pay for torture. I think there's a lot of things to do, and if you go to the website, there's ideas for things, too. And look for other people that want to do something about torture. That's the other, I mean, this is part of a community building thing where we really want to reach out and build and organize groups and communities that want to make sure this doesn't continue to happen. Because it's really not enough to say, well, I don't believe in torture. It's already too late for that because our country is torturing people with our tax dollars and in our name.
Jackie Ellen Dussault took part in the Witness Against Torture. She was one of 25 Catholic workers who went to Guantanamo Bay in Cuba to try to get access to see the conditions that the prisoners were in and perform works of mercy. And they were refused. She's just back from Cuba. And she also runs, along with her husband Chris Allen Dussault, the St. Martin de Porres Catholic Worker Community in Hartford, Connecticut. Jackie, thank you very much for being with us today.
And thank you for having me.
Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Simon Harrick, Jesuit priest and an organizer with the War Resisters League, who explains why 25 peace activists have traveled to the American naval base at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, to protest U.S. torture of detainees. Gregory Wilpert, a journalist living in Caracas who examines Venezuela's recent legislative election, where President Hugo Chavez won an overwhelming victory after opposition parties boycotted the vote. Ann Alden Meyer of the Union of Concerned Scientists, who assesses the progress made at the recently concluded United Nations Climate Change Conference in Montreal. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Rumors of a new American military base in Paraguay have been circulating since the South American government agreed to allow 13 U.S. joint military exercises that will run through December 2006. It is speculated the U.S. would establish a new military base only 124 miles from the border with Bolivia, in easy striking distance of Bolivia's rich natural gas fields, and that up to 500 U.S. troops would be based there. In late July, Brazil launched its own military maneuvers along the border region with Paraguay. In addition, Brazil's foreign minister, Celso Amorim, chastised its neighbor for inviting in the American military. According to the news magazine In These Times, Bolivia, which will have a closely contested presidential election on December 18th, has the most to fear from a U.S. base. For the last 2 years, massive protests by indigenous groups have rocked the nation and toppled two presidents. In polls for a new election, Evo Morales of the left-wing Movement Toward Socialism, or MAS party, holds a slim lead over former President Jorge Quiroga Ramirez, preferred candidate of the U.S. While Washington and Paraguay have denied any plans for an American military base, a recent trip by U.S. Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld fueled speculation that the Bush administration was eager to block Morales' election. Morales, the leader of coca leaf farmers and a good friend of Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez, has endorsed calls to nationalize Bolivia's natural gas reserves. The Washington Post reports that a newly disclosed 2003 memo shows that six staff lawyers in the U.S. Justice Department and two analysts asserted the Texas Congressional Redistricting Plan, pushed by then-House Majority Leader Tom DeLay, violated the Voting Rights Act, but that top officials in the Justice Department overruled staff opinion and approved the redistricting plan. DeLay is now under indictment in Texas for illegally diverting funds to the campaigns of Republican state legislators who drew the new map. Critics charged the plan, which used three-year-old census data and led to Republicans winning five new congressional seats, violated the concept of one person, one vote, and weakened the voting power of blacks and Hispanics. To dismantle a Latino-majority district for the explicit purpose of making sure they can't elect a candidate of their choice is a violation of the Voting Rights Act, said Nina Perales, Southwestern Regional Counsel for the Mexican-American Legal Defense and Education Fund. On Monday, December 12th, the Supreme Court agreed to consider the legality of the 2003 plan. Oral arguments will begin March 1, 2006, just 1 week before congressional primary races. Democratic Representative Lloyd Doggett, who saw his Austin and Travis County district dismantled in 2003, welcomed the court's decision to hear the case. He said, "With all this talk of spreading democracy abroad, I'm hopeful there might be some spreading of democracy at home now." Under the threat of a boycott from the arch-conservative American Family Association, Ford Motor Company has agreed to stop advertising its Jaguar and Land Rover vehicles in gay publications. Ford claimed it was a business decision, at the same time the car giant announced it was laying off 7,500 workers. The Mississippi-based AFA first targeted Ford in April for the carmaker's programs encouraging workplace diversity for gay and lesbian workers and making donations to gay rights groups like the Human Rights Campaign. Over the summer, conservative Christians put pressure on local Ford dealers in southern states. The dealers then urged top Ford executives to settle with the anti-gay AFA. However, the Ford-owned Volvo company will continue to run ads in gay publications. In a statement, AFA Chairman Donald Wildman praised Ford, saying, "They are acting on our concerns. We are pleased with the results, and therefore the boycott has been suspended." A joint statement by 19 gay rights groups expressed deep dismay that Ford entered into a confidential agreement with the AFA and called on the car company to disavow it. In response, Ford has agreed to meet with gay rights leaders in mid-December to explain its dealings with the anti-gay American Family Association. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
Allegations that the U.S. systematically mistreats and tortures terrorist suspects was the focus of attention again when Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice denied charges that Washington operates secret prisons in several Eastern European countries. Investigations have been launched by the European Union into the complicity of governments where these prisons may be located and whose territory may have been used to transport detainees. While President Bush and other U.S. officials have stated that America does not torture, prisoners who have been released from Guantanamo Bay have alleged that they were menaced with dogs and beaten while in American military custody. In protest of the treatment of terrorism suspects held at the Guantanamo Bay U.S. Naval Base in Cuba and other known and covert facilities around the world, 25 American Christian activists traveled to the gates of the prison and are demanding to meet with the detainees held there. The human rights campaigners flew to Cuba, then marched 80 miles on foot from Santiago to Guantanamo, arriving there on December 10th, International Human Rights Day. The group now sits at the gate, fasting and praying while awaiting permission to enter the U.S. base. Thus far, the Bush administration has not responded to the group's request. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Simon Harrick, Jesuit priest and anti-militarism coordinator with the War Resisters League. He explains why members of the War Resisters League and Catholic worker communities from across the U.S. have converged on Guantanamo in their witness to torture, protesting government policies that have led to the mistreatment of detainees.
They wanted to draw attention to the over 500 prisoners that we have there in Guantanamo Bay who are held there without charge and without evidence, or with secret evidence. So they don't know how they got in there, and they don't know how to get out. It's just remarkable. And in the meantime, while they're in this legal black hole that we've created, they are being tortured. The Red Cross made an extraordinary act. They usually are quite private about this, but they actually came out and said, no, these people are being tortured. They use the word tantamount to torture. So the Catholic workers and a number of the people from the WRL said, well, if this were happening on American soil, would we be there? And the answer was, of course, yes. But now they say, well, then what's to stop us from going to Cuba, especially since, as Catholic workers especially, we have the injunction from Jesus to visit the imprisoned, especially because the president on June the 20th said, well, if you're concerned, there were a whole bunch of people who were concerned about this. They said, well, he said, if you're concerned, well, then I invite you to go down there yourself to see there and to look at the facts. That's what the president said in Washington, D.C. So they did, of course. Now they're at Guantanamo awaiting for his permission to enter this prison camp where the torturing is taking place. And surprisingly enough, he's not giving it, even though they're responding to his invitation.
So what's the status? They walk from Santiago de Cuba. Where are they now, and are they at the gates?
Just outside the base. So there's a kind of a no man's land, as you know, between the Cuban forces and the American forces, and they're outside that no man's land, and they're fasting now and praying and asking people to call up the president and Rumsfeld and say, let us in.
Tell us, what's the primary message these 25 activists have brought to the gates of Guantanamo Bay, Cuba?
That the people in the United States, at least some people in the United States, do not approve of holding people without due process, without charge, without being able to see any evidence against them, and that these people do not approve of torture. And not only is that message that these walkers want to give, but there's a lawyer from Harvard, educated lawyer, Jennifer Harbury, who's been doing a long study on the effects of torture. She herself interviewed many people who were heads of intelligence services across the world for the past 10 years. And these folks say that they have not received, all over the world for the past 10 years, what they call actionable intelligence from torture. So that even if you were for human rights, which these people are, even if you aren't for the dignity of human beings, which as Christians they are, then even if you were saying that we need actionable intelligence, well, the intelligence heads across the world, including the United States, say we never get any actionable intelligence from this because people will say anything under torture. So I think the other thing, too, finally, that they're, because it's an explicitly Christian, even Catholic worker group, they also want to expose the hypocrisy of a government that claims to be Christian, that is torturing people and holding them without charges. If we want to go that far, is saying, on what side of the crucifixion would our government be? These folks are on the side of the people who are being crucified. Well, then what's the government doing? Our own government, which claims to be Christian, is doing the crucifying. So that's also something that they want to highlight as they walk there.
Reverend Herrick, the president and his advisors, Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice, have gone out of their way in recent weeks to assure the world that torture is not taking place, that the United States does not torture people held in captivity, that prisoners are not being shuttled to secret detention centers and tortured. How do you respond to the idea that the torture that has been reported, that this is all somehow an aberration, a group of bad apples that have defied their instructions from their superiors, that this is somehow just a few mistakes and not a policy?
They want to say if it's a few mistakes, then the question is, then how come it's repeated over and over again in every prison? It's every prison. There's not only, of course, Abu Ghraib, where the torture continues in Iraq, but there's Camp Buka and other camps, and the torture is exactly the same. And then when you go to Guantanamo and look at the torture that's taking place there, that's exactly the same. And then when people come back from these secret prisons, if they ever do get out, the handful that have gotten out, report how they're being tortured, and there are a number of British people who have just been released a few months ago, and they report on their torture, and it's all the same. When you see in case after case across the world that the torture that we're inflicting on people is the same, then it's hard to argue that it's a few bad apples. It looks much more like a universal policy. And when we look at the manuals for how to torture people that come from the School of the Americas, now we renamed the Western Hemisphere Institute for Security Cooperation, those manuals describe the kind of torture that we are training others to do that we are now inflicting.
That was Simon Herrick, Jesuit priest and anti-militarism coordinator with the War Resisters League. Contact the League by calling area code 212-228-0450 or visit the Witness to Torture website at www.witnesstorture.org. In another of a string of victories, Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez has won an overwhelming victory in his nation's December 4th legislative election. The president's Fifth Republic Movement won 114 out of 167 seats in the National Assembly, while allied parties won the balance. However, this electoral victory came after five major opposition parties boycotted the vote, resulting in only 25% participation by registered voters. The opposition parties, many of which supported the unsuccessful 2002 military coup against Chavez, complained that Venezuela's National Electoral Council favored government candidates, despite major changes made by the council in response to opposition grievances. President Chavez claimed the opposition's boycott of the election was prompted by polls showing they would have suffered an embarrassing defeat, a tactic he says that was backed by Washington to destabilize his government. Now, with commanding control of the legislature, Chavez will have a two-thirds majority in parliament that will allow him to change the Constitution, including a current limit of two presidential terms in office. Meanwhile, Venezuela is continuing its charm offensive by offering Caribbean nations, and now poor residents of Boston and New York, discounts on oil through its state-owned energy company, brand name Citgo in the U.S. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Gregory Wilpert, a sociologist and journalist living in Caracas who examines Venezuela's recent legislative election.
For a long time, the opposition parties here have been complaining about the Electoral Commission, which regulates and organizes the elections. And they had a number of different complaints. And actually, the Electoral Council or Commission gave in to almost every single one of the demands of the opposition parties leading up to the vote. For example, the Electoral Council had wanted to have fingerprint scanners to make sure that nobody votes more than once, but the opposition said that that would reveal the secret of the vote, perhaps, if you can correlate those fingerprint scans with the order in which people voted and, you know, when exactly they voted because they're voting machines. But the council actually decided to remove those, to concede to the opposition demand. But still, even though right after they conceded to one of these main demands, and actually there were a whole bunch of them, something like five or six separate demands, a couple days beforehand they withdrew from the election with no really good explanation other than we don't trust the electoral council. And so as a result, the participation, of course, was very low. That's something else that was covered extensively in the news, that only 25% participated, but they were essentially uncontested elections. That's not quite true. There were something like over 5,000 candidates for something like 187 seats, positions. So there were plenty of candidates, but the main opposition parties were not participating. And so it was clear that the opposition supporters wouldn't vote, and even Chavez supporters didn't really feel like voting either, since they were pretty certain that their side would win, which, of course, turned out to be true. The pro-Chavez side ended up getting all of the seats of the National Assembly in the end, and Chavez's own party, since he governs in a coalition, won something like two-thirds of the seats.
Greg Wilpert, there's been some speculation that public opinion polls foretold of a drubbing by Chavez's allied parties against the opposition, and that is one reason why they pulled out of the election. What have you heard about some of their motivation for pulling out?
Yes, I really think that's the main reason. The polls indicated that Chavez himself enjoys something like between 60 and 70% popularity, and it looked like the opposition parties would go down from almost half of the seats in the National Assembly to something like maybe 20 at the most out of 165 seats. So it seemed pretty clear that this was a preferable route for them, because that way they could continue their campaign of delegitimizing the Chavez government without having to face almost certain defeat at the polls. And there are actually several different things that indicate that this was the case, that their decision was based on this. For example, some of the main opposition parties never even campaigned. Leading up to the vote, a few days beforehand, before they pulled out, you couldn't see a single campaign poster of theirs on the street. So you really got the impression that they actually never had any intention at all of participating.
So did they not achieve the desired effect? Because here in this country, there are many people who are now calling, or who have long been calling, Hugo Chavez a dictator, and are reiterating that charge now that he has almost complete control of the government, with the opposition members of parliament drying up, basically, in the aftermath of this parliamentary election.
Well, here the opposition definitely thinks like it won a victory, which seems very bizarre. They're saying essentially that, yes, in international opinion, Chavez is going to be seen as a dictator and so on, and running a one-party state and all these kinds of arguments. But actually, when you look at the international media, at least, in terms of the op-ed pieces, while they are usually against Chavez, they are also unanimous in their condemnation of the opposition. Actually, the Washington Post, I don't know, most people don't even realize nowadays, is actually become extremely conservative in terms of its editorials. And they've always hated Chavez, but they clearly are saying that the opposition made a big mistake and that they acted like fools. And the New York Times actually had an editorial that said the same thing, essentially. So even though I don't agree with their position on what they're saying about Chavez, it doesn't seem like this was a victory for the opposition.
Greg, when it comes to the program of Hugo Chavez's government, now that they have undisputed control of the parliament, what is the government program? What can they do with this lopsided majority that they now have in terms of participatory democracy that they're pushing, social programs, press laws that the opposition has protested in recent months?
Well, I don't think much is going to happen in terms of press laws. I mean, the law that they passed essentially has regulations that are very comparable to the U.S. FCC regulation, broadcast regulations. But it goes further in many ways, not in terms of restricting the media, but in terms of democratizing it, actually. What's more likely on the agenda, I think, are perhaps two things. The more important one, I think, is efforts to continue inventing, so to speak, a participatory democracy. That is, they want to strengthen what's known here also as the social economy, to make it easier, for example, for the government to take over factories that have become bankrupt and turn them over to workers in order to continue production as a cooperative. Another thing are there are two laws they're working on right now. One has to do with strengthening and creating community councils to strengthen community and local democracy. And another has to do with turning over the property of the homes that people built in the slums. And almost half of Venezuelan population lives under such circumstances. And the effort is to turn over that land to the people who are living in it and have been living on it for almost 20 years in some cases.
That was Gregory Wilpert, a sociologist and journalist living in Caracas. Read his articles online at www.venezuelaanalysis.com. As representatives of 163 nations wound up climate change talks in Montreal in mid-December, many environmental groups were critical of what they saw as a lack of progress, and particularly the negative role of the U.S. government. Under the Bush administration, the U.S. unsigned the 1992 Kyoto Protocol Global Warming Treaty. The protocol sets a goal for industrialized nations to reduce carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gas emissions by 5% below 1990 levels by 2012, and to reduce emissions by 20% to 30% by the year 2020. The U.S., which currently produces 25% of emissions, is among the very few industrialized nations, including Australia, that have declined to participate in the Global Warming Treaty. Kyoto goals do not currently apply to developing nations such as India and China, even as emissions from those countries are contributing a greater percentage to the total amount of gases produced worldwide. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhu spoke with Alden Meyer, an energy specialist with the Union of Concerned Scientists, who has been working on climate change issues since 1989. While many analyses of the Montreal gathering believe the only result was to agree to more meetings, Meyer, who was very critical of the U.S. role, was nevertheless upbeat about the meeting and what it portends for the future of climate change work.
Clearly, the United States came in there hoping to derail the Kyoto Protocol and weaken the resolve of Europe, Canada, Japan, and other countries from moving ahead with the notion of binding limits on greenhouse gas emissions. And that strategy failed because they decided at this meeting in Montreal to launch the next round of negotiations over deeper cuts in industrial country emissions after 2012, and also to create a forum for constructive discussions with major developing countries like China, India, Brazil, about ways that they can participate more actively in the regime that's emerging globally.
Now, who's the they in this process?
The countries that are parties to the Kyoto Protocol, those that have signed up. So, of course, that does not include the United States, which under Bush pulled out of the whole process.
Are you just putting a happy face on this, or am I reading the wrong sources? The things I've been reading since the start of this latest meeting in Montreal have painted a much less rosy picture. I mean, the U.S. tried to derail the whole process. Are you only happy because that didn't happen? That seems like a pretty low bar to set.
No, actually, that was a major victory for people who would like to see tougher action in the future. I think the real political message out of Montreal is that the rest of the world realized, many of them for the first time, that the Bush administration position does not truly reflect where public opinion and action are going in the United States. There were a number of mayors up in Montreal, staff from governors, some of the states that are moving forward on their own, the business community initiatives that are underway, the religious groups. There was a lot of stuff on display up in Montreal for the rest of the world to see about how so much is happening in the U.S. outside of Washington, D.C., where, of course, both the Congress and administration are paralyzed by the fossil fuel lobby. And that gave Europe, Japan, Canada, some of the other countries, the courage to go ahead with the Kyoto Protocol process, despite the fact that the Bush administration is making clear that they will not come back in. I think people are now looking beyond this administration, looking at where the U.S. is going on this issue longer term, the likelihood that the next president, whether it's a Republican or Democrat, will be much more proactive and willing to re-engage with the rest of the world on the global warming issue. And they launched a process to start those discussions among themselves without the U.S. at the table able to block it. And that was the real goal that many of us had for this meeting, was to launch a strong process coming out to discuss the next steps after 2012.
Haldenmeier, I read an article where another scientist was quoted as saying that it's really too late already and we're toast, in his words. Do you think that's too negative?
Well, I think it clearly is getting late, and we would agree with those who say that there has to be much more of a sense of urgency around this, that basically we've really got the next 10 years to turn this situation around and start getting real action on the ground. But the reality is, if you look at what is happening in countries like China, they're not signing up for binding national limits like Europe and Canada did in the Kyoto Protocol, but they are taking some pretty significant steps at the domestic level. For example, China has set a goal of increasing renewable energy share of its electricity sector to 15% over the next decade. They are putting in place stronger fuel economy standards for new vehicles, passenger vehicles, than we have here in the U.S. So if you look at what's actually happening on the ground in some of these countries, there's a lot of good movement forward. We think that if they can be encouraged to come into the Kyoto process and link into some of the technology transfer and the financial markets that are being developed for carbon emission reductions there, that can help accelerate that process.
That was Haldenmeier of the Union of Concerned Scientists. Contact the group by calling area code 617-547-5552 or visit their website at www.ucsusa.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. Visit our website at www.btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and real audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly program summaries and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program is produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Bill Cosentino, Chris Ferriero, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Harry Minot, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.
Thanks for listening to Making Waves, Independent Voices for Peace and Justice. The Making Waves crew is Amy Antonucci, Steve Diamond, Tom Jackson, Stanley Longstaff, Joanne Paradise, Damon Thomas, and Jeff White. We welcome your participation, too. Please email us at nhmakingwaves@yahoo.com to get involved. Tune in next Saturday from 2 to 4 for our next Making Waves program. We leave you now with this quote from Camilo Mejia. Behind these bars, I sit a free man because I listen to a higher power, the voice of my conscience.